Final Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. Sorry about the delay, there was a misunderstanding, but we're here now, so that's fine. I'm now here with Scott Mannion, Scott, welcome to Millennial. Would you like to introduce yourself briefly to the audience?
Yeah, sure. Hey, everyone. So I'm was a film director. I've worked in the industry for 15 years. I made a film called The Defector, which is a Cold War thriller, which was directed by Russell Boyd, Academy Award winner Russell Boyd, and edited by Matt Villa. Directed other films, worked in commercials, directed commercials, that sort of thing. But what happened is, as we all know, although it was already infected by a neoliberal parasite anyway, it was just more subtle propaganda. I always knew that, but with everything going to shit in the world, we can swear on this, right? With everything going to shit in the world, I just want to make propaganda for scumbags, and wanted to play my part in trying to do my duty to try really figure out what constitutes what makes us tick, the English value hierarchy, right? To recover it, the Anglo-Saxon-ness of it, because that it's also an opportunity as well for artists as well, because of the propaganda, it's made people deeply want to seek out this thing. Where is it? What makes us tick? Who are we? And they're all going online in their droves to read stories, they're happy to listen to a storyteller just tell it verbally, as opposed to watch a Star Wars series that is, vilifying our ways of life, even though they've got this wider, powerful graphics, visual effects and such. They're more willing than ever to just watch a storyteller, to watch people like you go online. So yeah, I mean, that's essentially who I am. That's what I do, really. It's looking into our deep lore and the deep nature of who we are, to rearticulate it to in a way that people understand that it's still in our being. It's in their being right now, in their behaviors, in their patterns of behavior. That's what I do. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what you said there is interesting, because I have an aversion to big budget blockbuster stuff with huge special effects and a bombastic soundtrack and all that. I mean, I can have it sometimes, but I much prefer small scale, low budget, intimate drama with not many special effects or anything like that. It's just my own personal thing and what I'm accustomed to. Is I got into 70s TV when I was small, just by accident, really. And so that's what my own personal thing. So when I see big budget contemporary stuff, it's overwhelming. It's too much. And so I think with that in mind, it's understandable why people gravitate towards, and certainly not everyone, but a large number of people gravitate towards stuff like, the kind of material that we're producing right now, which is not fancy. It's not overwhelming. It's not overbearing. It's just people talking about something meaningfully and hopefully honestly. Yeah. And I think it's understandable that people get something from that they absolutely don't get from the mainstream. I mean, even the BBC is huge budgets nowadays.
Yes. Well, yeah, the thing is, right, is that it's fidelity. It's because it's not just, okay, that you've probably heard the saying that truth has higher fidelity. A truth in a world of lies, truth is like a revolution. When you look to a story, the procedures in it, say if it's authentically Anglo-Saxon, right? It's of your value hierarchy. That means it's true to Anglo-Saxon way of being on the ground. So it means if you imitate the procedures of the character in the story that you tell on your channel or whatever, if you imitate that in reality, it fits with reality. So it has a higher fidelity as well. If you imitate a woke narrative in reality, what happens? It doesn't work because it's contrary to reality. So it has a higher fidelity. So it's not only that people don't like production value, it's also because they're seeking that deep authenticity of the truth. And the truth isn't propositional. The truth isn't science. It's true to our being. You know, I mean, you're a Scot. Are you a Lowland Scot or a Highland Scot?
Lowland.
Yeah, well, then basically you're English, essentially. I mean, with respect to where you're from. I mean, Carlyle recognized this. Carlyle recognized he was a northern man, and he was probably from where you're from, right? So, yeah, it's as much important to your stock as it is to anyone else's. Perhaps not as much to a Highlander, but, yeah.
Yeah, Well, this I think you've touched on something, because obviously the new Lord of the Rings thing, the Rings of Power, has fallen almost flat. It's been a huge disappointment for many people, but including Amazon.
Yeah, thank God for that. Yeah,
yeah. And part of this does seem to be that it's based on woke premises. It does, and this is amazing, because you know, obviously coming with the source material being Tolkien, you would think they're going to have to adhere to some degree the premises of that, but they instead they've sort of grafted it onto modern woke ideology. And I think that this does strike people as just alien and unfulfilling. What would you have anything to say about the Rings of Power and so on?
Yeah, I think fundamentally those two people who wrote that are symptomatic of the placelessness of the transitory airport that is Los Angeles, which is essentially a place of basically cultural ghettos. It's a place of nowhere. You can't compete with Tolkien. It's like almost like Critical Drinker said, is that this guy, a dusty professor in his office, defeated you with all your money. He defeated you because he had it. And this is the truth of it, right? You can't write Tolkien unless you imbued yourself with the being that's around you. You can't write this stuff, right? You can't. Propaganda is something when you enter into something, and this is what studio executives do. The message is a real thing, right? They think that theme starts first. You never write from theme. Theme is something that emerges from it. It's like the moral of a story. A moral of a story is the reason for the outcome of the actions of the person, right? People in houses shouldn't throw stones. The person, you only figure that out at the end, right? And it emerges at the end. The moral emerges at the end. You don't write it from that position, because it's a context that emerges. And what Tolkien said about that is that his stories aren't allegory, they're applicable. They're applicable because he's led it into his being, right? He was a professor of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford. He lived in Oxford. He had an Anglo-Saxon church next to him. He's let it into his being, and then he's written it after that. Whereas these types of people, these woke chaps, from the outset, they're top-downing it, which there's a difference between propaganda. So say people on our side, if we want to do a traditional story, we should, but what we shouldn't do is do it in this top-down way, where you go, oh, I'm going to make a trad story. And then you go, I'm going to make it about, I don't know, masculinity or whatever it is. And if you do it top-down, it'll just feel like a gay allegory, right? It won't work. But if you surround yourself with masculinity, if you surround yourself with whatever this culture is, then it will naturally come out of it. And the same thing, you know, these Christian movies that people make. And I'm Christian, yes. So there's nothing against that. We know they're bad, right? And the Christians get this, though. And Mel Gibson films aren't bad. He's a Christian because he gets it. He imbues himself with the tradition, then just writes naturally, lets it come out of him in the first draft, and then you figure out what the theme might be. Whereas the reason why this whole thing got wokeified, studio executives and the way they're trained from the ground up, a lot of these guys come from the agencies, like UTA, CAA. They, in the mailroom, they're trained to write these coverage sheets, and on these coverage sheets, they have the message on the front of it. They're actually supposed to summarize the message, right? And so when you get to the studio level, you're not reading the scripts on the ground. You get the coverage sheet from the mailroom, which has the message on the front of it, and then, of course, it gives you a synopsis of the rest of the story. And so immediately, what's in their interest, right? Oh, I made a great film, but that was the filmmakers, wasn't it? But if they made something which had a good message, then that's something they can share at cocktail parties. And, well, yeah, I promoted that film, didn't I? That was all about, I did that. That's my thing. So, you know, but if it's just, oh, a great film that you made, oh, great film, you know, that, but you're not really responsible for it. But if you gave a platform to that message, so really the industry was waiting. It was just waiting. This neoliberal, it was already degenerate, but this neoliberal thing was just waiting to be possessed by this demon. I wouldn't even call it demon. I'd just call it a demon, because it is a kind of distributed cognition. It's a hyper agency. It's this thing is decentralized. I mean, can we not look at this now? Can we get to the position where we can actually? Cognitive scientists are talking about this now. They are articulating this woke thing, not as just a mind virus, but as a hyper agency between the brains of all the people, if you want to talk about it like that. But yeah,
let's get to that in a moment, because first, sure, I'd like to say that I completely agree with you about if a story is built, if it's made to spread a message, to communicate a moral thing, I mean, you can do it, but you have to do it carefully, because if the primary purpose of it all is, well, I just want to come up with a story to spread this message, it ends up being propaganda, and it ends up being crass, and usually it ends up being an unsatisfying story. It's not organic. Yes. It doesn't feel right. The characters aren't well-rounded. They're clearly just there to make that point. And it's unsatisfying. Mm. And, you know, this has been a thing for a long time. I've seen things from the 70s, the 80s, talking about this, where it has to actually be a good story. It has to actually be enjoyable, and you have to actually care about the characters and be invested in them and be fascinated by them and all this. Now, I watched one episode, the first episode of The Rings of Power, and I'm not a Tolkien guy. I actually still haven't read or seen The Lord of the Rings, just because I don't know how that happened. Don't ask me. I have no idea. Just somehow I didn't have it there as a child. But I am familiar. I mean, obviously, you can't not be familiar with it. So I know vaguely what it is, what it's about, the characters, and the overall tone, and in every sense of that word. And the Rings of Power, I watched it out of morbid curiosity, and the first episode. And what was clear was that it comes from a modern perspective. Basically, and I saw this with Doctor Who as well, and with Robin Hood, the 2000s version, and with Merlin, the 2000s version. What they've got is basically that it's modern people wearing funny clothes.
Yeah.
And in a funny sense, oh, well, is this quaint? Yeah. But that's really it. There's no sense of, well, this is actually a culture, this is actually a place, and here's a well-rounded character involved in all of these things, and that it doesn't feel like that at all. It feels just modern millennials transposed into some quirky setting.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you've got the propaganda.
Yeah. Well, it's inauthentic, isn't it? Fundamentally, because you've got these people that are so, of course, we know, this is the point, we all see it, we watch it. It's so on the nose that you see these people in this village, and it's all these different races of people. Like, what are you doing? And this is just so inauthentic. I mean, even just from a basic, there's a few different points when you do these things. It's probabilistic. It must be probable, or else it breaks out of the story. It must be applicable. And it's just not. It's not applicable. It makes no sense. They did, and Amazon, it's just the way they're placing it, the way they're doing it in all their series. This other one called the Dragon Reborn, I can't remember what it's called. But the same thing. What are you doing? And there's a competence issue with the people they're hiring as well. And I think what fundamentally does look like, it does look like cosplay. It looks like cosplay. It looks like we've turned up at a ridiculous meeting of some fan club. You know what it is? It's like a 12th form fan film, you know? Does it not feel a bit like that? It doesn't matter how much money you throw at this stuff. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how big your CG scenes, because of the inept people you've hired that just don't have the experience, you can just tell behind it, it doesn't have the spirit, this fire. You know, even the costumes, that you can tell, they've thrown millions and millions at them, but the artistic mind behind it, he just wasn't the best.
Exactly.
Wasn't the best guy.
It feels generic. I mean, this is something I noticed. It's like, where's the love here? Where's the engagement? By the, it feels like, okay, it's like an AI algorithm has been told medieval fantasy castle.
Yes.
Do it. And the algorithm has run and it's just come up with that. And same with the costumes. Everything about it was really interesting, actually, how that happens. It's just complete, because they're still getting paid the same amount. Mm. You'd think that they would be able muster the enthusiasm and get engaged in it. But one question that is interesting is about the writers, because everything ultimately, I think you'll agree, everything comes down to the script, the writers.
Yeah.
So, and you said there's a competence issue there. what do you have any explanation for this? I mean, why is it that with the resources of Amazon, they can pay anyone any salary imaginable? How can't they find people who are good at writing?
I think with those who write, this is actually a case of hubris. It's the fact that they thought they could do it, but they are, like I mentioned a bit earlier, is that they are from the nowhere place. They thought, we're from the nowhere place. They thought they didn't think we're from the nowhere place, but they're from the nowhere place. They thought, we could do Tolkien. We'll just make it sound Shakespearean. You can see their woeful attempt. Do you think these guys really understand Shakespeare? Shakespeare's the Geist of England. They don't understand Shakespeare. They've just a pale imitation they've thrown into this to make... It's almost like... It's so pathetic. It's almost as if they've gone, they realized their weakness, their incompetence, right? And thought, we'll just make it sound a bit Shakespearean, the dialogue, and maybe we'll get away with it, right? Whereas Tolkien, authentically, it came out of his being. I mean, this isn't trivial, what I'm talking about. It's not, what do you mean, Scott, by his being, if you're a materialist watching this? No, being is the world. Like epistemology, humans are this existential being. It's the and like the Englishman fundamentally is the landscape brought into his being. The Scotsman is fundamentally the landscape brought into his being. You can't do this without having that fundamental ground, especially because Tolkien had that. And it just goes to show IP does matter. You can't repeat things unless you do the work. And he spent years and years looking into it, trying to recreate a myth.
Sorry, this is an interesting thing. He was actually quite old by our standard, you know. He was let me just see how old he actually was. I think he was in his 50s.
Would have been 40 50s. And even it weighed on him. I'm just filling in while you're searching this. It weighed on him. Did you find it? It weighed on him. That is that he had to fit what he was doing, his grand mythos, into the hardship of storytelling, the requirements of storytelling, because it's hard to tell a story.
But he would have been 45 when he started 45. Writing it. When he started writing it, and 57 when he finished writing it. So that's, I mean, and you know, it's not old, it's not ancient, but it shows that he'd been an adult for thirty years by the time he started it.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of time to absorb and learn. And then his early life, he would have been absorbing the landscape and the feel of things. People from LA or whatever are not going to be immersed in that thing.
These J.J. Abrams fuckheads, these fucking douchebags come in thinking, we're going to put some Lost, we're going to have a box that opens and we won't show the audience the box. And they'll think, what's in the box, right? That's that whole J.J. Abrams way of doing things, that whole Lost thing. Oh, it's the organism. What is this black darkness? Yeah, that mystery is a tool that you can use, but no one's going to spend 12 episodes waiting for one mystery to be revealed. That's how empty. They thought they could put this Gandalf character in at the start and think people are going to wait 12 episodes to reveal that. No, you need some substance to provide them with something while you wait. You know what I mean, right? Did you watch the whole thing?
I didn't watch. I just watched the first episode. But I heard about this. I saw a clip because it spread around. You know, I saw clips of the Gandalf guy and all that.
They set up a bunch of things that were sort of weak mysteries. You can do that. That's a good trick, right? It's a good storytelling thing. I've done it. I did it in my film. If you watch The Defector, it does a similar sort of thing, right? It's not going to sustain 12 episodes. You need the substance of the deep mythos. And they touch on bits of it. When you see Elrond with... Well, unfortunately, they gave him these stupid Patrick Swayze haircuts, right? What were they thinking? I don't know. But you see with Elrond and the dwarf, there's a kind of relationship there which works. There's something in that that they could have stuck with if they'd just gone with what was natural to it. And they just insert this this African woman, which has no place in this. It's just I saw a little smile appear when I said African woman. But they put this African woman, it was just ridiculous, right? And they made her, the costume she's wearing is kind of like Wakanda, you know, which is just ridiculous.
Indeed. You know, it was as if they were going for that. They were sort of emphasizing, by the way, she is African. Yeah, you're right. She's African. It was a strange decision that. I guess it's that's the sort of basic mechanical incompetence about telling a story. They don't seem to. The setup and payoff is too elongated. The characters are not interesting at all. And And you don't really know what any of them believe in either. That's another thing. Like Galadriel. So you don't really, like, she believes in good. And she's, but everyone around her doesn't seem to be so sure. It's like they're all a bit stupid or, you know, they don't get it. So it's just this power girl, this girl boss.
Yes.
And then, of course, you've got the complete lack of realism there when she's battling the, I've forgotten what it was called, the snow monster.
Yeah, that's a stupid thing to start.
Absurd. Completely over the top. But then fundamentally, it's what is this really all about? And that's the thing, you know, a story ultimately is, you know, you've got the form of it, you've got the characters who sustain it, you've got the explicit themes, what's going on visibly, and then you've got the subtext, the actual substance, what is this really about? And, I didn't get a sense that there was any of that going on here. Now, as I say, I only watched one episode, but this is partly why I only watched one episode.
Yeah.
It's just so crap.
Yeah.
But to get to what we wanted, what we intended to talk about, you were saying, well, the geist of Englishness, and you started talking about daemons, and you were saying that wokery is not quite a daemon. So why don't you start by describing what a daemon is, what that word means?
Well, it's Plato's word. Essentially, it describes a... It comes out of demos, demos is democracy, that's where that comes from too. It has the same root. So it essentially represents a kind of spirit of a landscape, a spirit of a people that emerges out of that. And so if we want to understand that outside of the classical understanding, though, which is the words that scientists are using, cognitive scientists are using now, is hyper-agency, which is essentially, it's higher than a human. It's above. I mean... The ancients understood these things. The Christians would call it, I'm Christian, but the principality. It's sort of, think about it like a geography over many mind. It's a thing. If you want to talk more materialistically about it, you could call it a meme complex across many minds. Not a mind virus in the case of positive ones. People are calling these egregores. That's another mythical word to describe these things. But these, I mean, okay, let's use it. Like Jung, for instance, is describing these things. He was talking about daemons as well. He would call it a daemon, but he had another word for it, which is essentially archetype. So for the idealist types, these things are in the unconscious. Well, you notice their pull, but in this day and age, we would see them as something that you're pulled towards something. You'll say, oh, it's just some urge. But the ancients would articulate these things as these hyper-agencies. Gods are hyper-agencies, for instance, right? So Jung empirically observed these phenomena across many people in a therapeutic setting again and again and again. He wouldn't have talked about it otherwise, right? Jung, fundamentally, he presented all his results empirically, but he was an idealist in the sense that he believed in a physical reality, but he believed it was intersubjectively manifested. So the traditional school would say that a daemon is kind of a manifestation. Say this world that around all of us is the manifestation, right? Our world that we see. This is manifestation. The traditional school would say manifestation, symbols, and gods that appear are an appearance of something, a principle that's behind that, which is what Plato would say, is that the forms are behind manifestation, right? So... Yeah, and Jung believed the same thing, is that these archetypes appear again and again. They come from the unconscious, but they can also appear in reality itself. So he believed that the collective unconscious was something that was in the unconscious. So you'd have the archetypes appear in dreams, daemons, and you'd be pulled from the unconscious, but also sometimes they can appear in reality, manifested, right? So that might sound strange to materialists watching this, but anyway, it's interesting. And if you look to the ground of quantum mechanics, they don't know shit about the fundamental of reality. Idealism is just as it's just as reasonable as something to suggest. If you look at Bernardo Kallstrop, he is a very rigorous philosopher who presents idealism in a way that is forceful. And even John Vivekia, a scientist, spoke with him, sort of debated with him recently. John Vavaki is a physicalist and talked about emergence, and they debated, and he recognized that neither one of us can say what the truth of the ontology is, right? So idealism is just as reasonable. So these forces, they could, I mean, look, Bernardo Kastrup talks about these forces and said they could, he instinctually thinks that, yes, they seem real, but he thinks they could be, there's no analytical reason why that needs to be the case, but they are, yeah. I mean, look, I think they are real. I mean, look, you just had Tom on. He believes they're real in the sense of gods, right? It's these things are real. And even if you don't, even if it's just, because if you just say they're just epistemological, you'd say, okay, that we created them just because they're useful. But fact is, those atoms in your brain are very real manifestations. They're very real movements. So why are they not real? But anyway, I digress. Throw it back to you.
I understand what you're saying there. I mean, it's something that occurs to me that we seem to be living in an age now where many people spontaneously behave in destructive ways, malicious ways, and hateful ways, and unnecessarily nasty, like sadistic ways. There's cruelty going on at a huge scale. And I don't think I really need to justify that statement. I would just say things like Drag Queen Story Hour, for example, the whole trans thing, pushing it on kids, the general incredible corruption in our governments, the political parties, in the media, in everything. And so it occurs to me that why are so many people spontaneously and in different ways behaving in this way? And I would suggest, and I'm not even saying this with any certainty, but it seems to me logical to assume that this is because they are all being affected at the same time by something elemental, something in the ether. And in a different age, perhaps they were affected by something different, which is why people spontaneously did the right thing, what we would sometimes call the Christian thing, Christian behavior, whatever. And I'm not saying that it's just Christian. I'm just saying that was what they called it. So it seems to me quite likely that at different times there are different elemental forces dominating in the world. And so when you're like in our age now, where you see so much corruption, you see so much wickedness, and you wonder why is this happening and how to combat it, the question becomes sort of metaphysical. And it's not just a matter of punishing the guilty, because there are so many guilty, and there are so many latently guilty and potentially guilty and about to be guilty. How would you get this under control? And I'm not saying that there is an answer. I'm just saying I think this goes beyond individual choices. I think there's something in the air.
Yes. Fundamentally, so who do you think you're talking to when you're speaking to an idea? When you're speaking to an ideologue of this, you're not talking to an individual. You're talking to it. It feedbacks to it when it gets its answers and feeds back to its wider network. I know this sounds, but people are talking about this. Engineers are talking about this. I'm not the only one. Cognitive scientists are talking about this. But so who do you think you're talking to? You're not. And the only defense, if you think these things aren't real, they're going to automatize in you and rule you. So you better be ready. And the only defense against this sort of thing is a positive one. If you don't have anything, if you think, science is going to protect you. Science is going to protect. It's not going to. None of this. The regime narrative, it's all falling away. And this hyper-stational acceleration of technology is revealing it. Can't we see it in memes? What do you think Pepe is? Pepe, on my channel, I spoke to Gio Panettetti, who you're having on soon too. We're talking about this, and someone commented and said, "Oh, that memes aren't mythos, but aren't they? Who do you think selected Pepe? Do you think Pepe is just random, or do you think it's a principle behind reality? Pepe, it's gone everywhere. Something in you selected it. Something behind the veil selected Pepe. He's green, for instance. It's like the Robin Hood. It's green. He's a kind of Robin Hood figure. 4chan is the Greenwood. It's Robin Hood, right? It's this rebellious free speech uprising of something. It's the unconscious, and no one person selected Pepe. Some person, something in them, behind the veil, a principle behind manifestation. Ah, that suited it. That's me. And it grabbed it and posted it. Why did this meme spread everywhere? Oh, that's Pepe. Why, though? You have to ask. What in you responded to Pepe and got you to go, that's perfect, I'll use Pepe as well? Right? It's not you as an individual going, oh, no, so many people did because it's something behind that, isn't it?
Yeah. I just remember when that whole thing took off and Hillary Clinton was doing her Reno speech, and it was in 2016, just before the Trump election. And she mentioned, I think she mentioned the alt-right or something. She said something, and a guy in the audience went, Pepe! And you actually heard it. You heard it on the cameras. It was picked
Groiper,
up.
Groiper. Yeah. Yeah.
It was very, very interesting moment. And I remember thinking, like, there was a thing at the time that this is sort of metaphysical. Memes are real. Meme warfare is a real thing. I mean, I'm not sure what I think about that. But I do, I am very sympathetic to the idea of, as I said, elemental forces. That's just my own term for
it. It's not all memes. I'm not saying all memes. It's there. That was one particular one that I think there's something in the unconscious that says, yes, that image suits my form, right? Again, a hyper-agency. Perhaps. I'm not 100% sure, and I haven't deeply gone into analytical, but philosophizing about whether Pepe been selected by a hyper agent. I'm more certain about older ones, but that one, that's just speculation I'm saying there. But yeah, but it does seem like it is more than just a meme. It seems like something selected it, right? Something that's intersubjective, you could say. Again, I don't want this. It might sound woo to people. I'm not being woo about it, right? I'm not. It's speculative. I'm saying it's speculative. But yeah, so anyway.
Well, another way to speculate about it is that Pepe wasn't selected by a force, but he was rejected by an opposing force. You know, so the people who, like Hillary Clinton, for example, the people who animate her, or the force that animates her, was allergic to Pepe. And so it was sort of like a kryptonite sort of thing. That's another possible way to look at it. But so what else would you have to say about daemons and this sort of thing historically? I mean, is this something that, is there a sort of track, a history of this, that at different times, different things have been influential in the world?
Yeah, I mean, look, let's get real about it. Let's just talk about something that's very simple and real. Santa Claus or a sports team? A sports team, fundamentally, it's a group of chads, a group of men that get together, that perform a team thing, and as they do what they're doing, under a coach, a sort of distributed cognition begins to form. It's greater than any one person, even the coach, right? There's a reason why a mascot emerges as it. What's the mascot? It's the daemon. That's a very base level of understanding what I'm talking about. And Santa Claus, for instance, when you say, ho, 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 Merry Christmas, little boy. I mean, who are you enacting there? You're not enacting yourself. The kid recognizes it's Santa when you do that, and you're not speaking as your own person. You're embodying a procedure, and it's you're embodying something that was passed to you from someone else, a meme complex. It's a very simple one. That's just for a simple everyday example where you can see that is a daemon, right? A very simple one. A sports team is more a direct one that is influencing you. And you can see, say you look at, You'll Never Walk Alone, the Liverpool sports team. If you look at the very early recordings of this song where it was emergent and people sang it on their own, when it wasn't just, when it wasn't played by the establishment who owns the team, you see the sway in the crowd. This emergent thing where it just comes up and they all start singing together. That's a similar thing. It's a very simple emergence. They all sing the song together of the football team. That's one unit. That's one thing. It's when humans get together. There's a great book by, I can't remember who it's, Levi Brune or something, but he talks about participation mystique, which is mysticism, really. It's just a primitive mentality saw these things in a way much different than we do. They sort of, they were a part, a constituent part of the wider tribe. So we existed in these states very early on where essentially it was a daemon, where your ancestors, you would get a name from your ancestors when you entered the, you go into a rite of passage, and you'd be given a name, and that name would continue on. That name was part of a wider network of this collective representation that you entered, and before you entered that, you weren't really a soul. But when you're given the name, you entered it, and all the different idols that were connected to it were actually you. So if your name was said for the natives, and for us from a very early age, that presence, the whole collective representation. So your presence was felt when your name was used, right? It's only, we separated that when logic emerged. We separated it out. We, you know, this is the philosophers, right, of the classical age. It's this, because they were assaulted. They were assaulted by gods that cleared themselves. They were under attack by these things. And they were trying to and push down and say, no, here's what logic means, this and this and this, because they're trying to bring form to something because the world was so harsh and, you know, chaotic to them. We're the opposite. We're at the point where we have this solidified logos, right?
Yeah.
And so we need to reconnect with these forces. And we can see it. We can see it as things start to dissolve, technology starts to speed up and connect us. Are you guys not noticing, everyone watching this? Are you not noticing on the internet principalities emerging, right? Even people following people on our side of things. You've got principalities of people. Is the sort of the Nietzscheans. There's the Heideggerian. These are principalities of a dead spirit, right? These things. And you go, okay, this is just a wooey way of talking about it, but is this not a more efficient way of describing the phenomena? Is this not a more effective, more pragmatic way of understanding the forces at work?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to look at an ant colony, and you could analyze the activities of each individual ant in it, or you could say this ant colony is, this group are doing this thing, and it's a collective average of all of their activities. Mm. And that would be a true statement to make. So it's a matter of, you know, which level do you want to analyze and perceive and characterize what's going on here? Mm. Because it's still true at different whichever level you choose. I think when you talk about like the different principalities on the internet, yes, it's made up, each one of those is made up of individuals, but ultimately it is a war between these principalities, or a contest, or a collaboration, or whatever, between these different principalities. So I think that is true. I think that is a perfectly valid way of characterizing what we see on the internet.
Also, I mean, okay, let's look at this. Why is the abstraction and analytic of abstracting becoming less and less effective at all-encompassing analyzing these things? Abstraction as in pulling something like science does out of its context, that's abstraction, right? That was really effective with Newtonian mechanics. That was really effective with, how does this billiard ball bounce off that? But that is becoming more and more useless. That's why complexity science exists. It's a different way of analyzing these things, non-reductive way of analyzing. So the ancients understood all-encompassing ways, and symbols would emerge from the unconscious, which were all-encompassing. All a symbol is basically a psychotechnology that you use to mediate the wider phenomena that's going on, to understand it, right? So, yeah, that's all they are. When you look at, again, when you say, if you look at the monarch ceremony, those sacred symbols can be used to understand, you analyze them to understand what's going on in the ceremony. Englishness, for instance, right? Like those things are more effective, Jonathan Pajot would talk about this and say the same thing, is that the ancients understood these things better than our abstracting way. We're getting better at this non-reductive way of analyzing things, this like cognitive science uses, but the ancients were always doing it that way. They were always looking at things in an all-encompassing way. Yeah, but I just have to go to the bathroom. Can you talk for a second? I go to the bathroom. Or is that going to be?
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. Don't worry. That's
yeah,
fine.
Okay.
Well, I hope everyone's doing well. I'll just mute his microphone. There we go. So yes, I hope you're all enjoying Millennial. actually, I should say, and it's something I meant to emphasize, that the PO box, if you want to send Christmas cards for the Christmas Eve stream, you really should do it right now. Because tomorrow is the 16th. That's absolutely the last time that you'll be able to do it if you want the cards to be read out on the stream on Christmas. It's Christmas Eve, but it'll actually be the wee hours of Christmas Day. So something I meant to make more of a thing of, but I forgot. But I do think that I know that quite a few cards have already arrived, so it should work. I think there'll be enough to sustain the stream. I'm just saying, if you want to send one yourself and add to that, you can do that. And of course, it's not all about the Christmas stream, that particular stream on Christmas Eve. So, you know, that deadline, once it passes, you can still send a card if you would like to. So don't worry about that. Also, the NFT is, I'm still working on it. Next year, I'll hopefully manage my time better. But there were several screw-ups, several obstacles this year with the computer and with me getting ill. But next year, I'll try to be aware of that and have everything ready, like at least 2 weeks in advance of the millennial actually starting. But anyway, the NFT is on the way. So there we go. Welcome back, Scott.
They're great, aren't they? I have some NFTs as well that I made, which is basically the Geist of Robin Hood.
Right.
What are yours? Are they?
Well, I've done one last year for Millennial 2021, and it was of the. Actually, you might know of this. It was the white stag that got killed in Merseyside last year. I think it was September, and it was a dreadful story. Yeah. And so that became sort of the emblem of Millennial last year, and it was made with a stained glass thing, different segments. It was really nice. I was very proud of it, and that was in the Millennial stuff. And the NFT was a separate thing where it was sort of animated, vector graphic. So it was lovely. I was very pleased with it. This year it's the figure eight, because this is the eighth millennial. But I haven't revealed it yet, but I'll probably finish it in the next few days. And then people can bid on it up until the 30th. So it's kind of go.
It's kind of appropriate, because if a lot of people are talking about cyclical time now, you know, that Spenglerian.
Oh, yes, you know, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I think it's likely that history goes. I mean, it rings true. It just seems logical. It seems likely.
In being as in the being that is us, in the happening that is us. I mean, that's the problem. That's what Spengler talks about too, is that this causal way of looking at reality, of nature, that's not us, because we are the openness. We are this being that has this happening underneath, and that every, say, but a line of causality of history, you can't use causal, oh, that thing happened in the happening, that event. No, but what about all the being underneath that was motivating all of it on the timeline, right? And that stuff has cycles. That stuff has... I agree. Jung thought that too, is that these archetypes manifest themselves again and again. They come along, and that if you look at ancient cosmology, you're looking at. It's really interesting when, even when you look at where Stonehenge is. So fascinating is that they have the zodiac there, right on the ground. That was the being of the people there, their being of the heavens. They imprinted on the ground there. And they saw that the zodiac is cyclical too. There's a place we're in, and that certain zodiac, and that moves on. And there's that great European traditionalist thinker, René Guénon. That's an anglicization of his name, but
yes,
he talks about that a lot, that cyclical time. And I think you can see that. And that we can take heart in that and look to more tradition now, because I think the people that don't, the progressive types, they're going to have an existential crisis. They are going to implode. But if you get traditional and you look into these things, you'll be prepared. Build the ark. Start looking now into it, and you'll be prepared for it, because shit's going to get real. Shit's going to get bad if you're not prepared.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the progressive politics is built on the idea that everything's going to get better, but it also it's built on the... It requires that everything remain pretty damn good. And so if things get rough, as I think they're going to, then belief in progressive politics, I just think, becomes untenable. I mean, for example, I think feminism will go out the window the day that it's no longer tenable. I think that it's just inevitable. It's a luxury belief, basically.
Yeah, and I think fundamentally that, though, I'm not blackpilled at all. I think that even in the building of the Ark, there's a resurgence. I feel there's a brewing resurgence in people. Fundamentally, underneath, they haven't defeated. Authentically, English or Scotch being is there underneath. It's just been covered with these propositions, and they fall away. They're weak. These liberal ideas and fake values that they've plastered, that they put on at the technical colleges, they put on the wall. I've seen them at in Swindon. I saw them on the wall at technical college there, the government. They're all fake values, like tolerance, fake value. We're welcoming. We're not tolerant. Get effed. No. There's an expectation that you will eventually become in Englishness if you were to go to a place you come in, and this is a feeling, it's a moral impulsion, it's not a propositional thing, right? It's
underneath. I agree, and this is why I don't like this idea that an identity or a culture is all about values, because values are like German values are pretty much the same. Everyone will say the same thing. I believe in fair play. Who doesn't?
That means nothing. It doesn't exactly mean anything.
So it's not so much about values as about attitudes, and attitudes towards values. I think that's what more characterizes peoples.
Well, yes, because ultimately the propositional Kantian value, really, that's just a propositional rendering of something, right? So the Englishman must always overcome tyranny. Okay, there's an example of one, right? That is a propositional rendering of a moral impulsion, though. The actual value is something that's in you, it's in me, and it responds to a certain context, right? So it's like a recipe. A recipe has basically a procedure and its outcome. That's kind of like a hero story, right? The procedure and its outcome. But outside that recipe is a whole context of skills, whole context of Englishness around that. So when Kant did this and rendered it into a proposition, this is before we knew there was perspectival knowledge, before we knew there was procedural knowledge and participatory knowledge, right? So underneath that recipe, say you've got Robin Hood's story. Tommy Robinson is a great example of this, right? Robin Hood is deeply in our psyche. When Tommy Robinson displayed his behaviors, which were that a state tyranny arises, an unfair situation arises, and he responds, and his behavior against the sheriff of Nottingham was like Robin in his Greenwood. He's funded by a populace. He's funded by people underneath him, right? So he's fitting again. He's wearing Robin Hood without even realizing it. So Tommy Robinson doing this, fighting the state, gathers popular support, which again all happens in the Robin Hood legends. It's in our psyche. And the reason that is, you admire him. You can't help but admire him. But what is that fundamentally? It's something in you that attaches to him. Or else why would it trigger in the first place, right? It's the context. It's the context of the situation of the state tyranny. It's the context of an individual from underneath, from the, you know, wherever he was from. And his accent, too, is the yeoman farmer. It's a yeoman freeholder who has a popular support. Those things all trigger. But it's more than just a proposition, though. It's more than just that simple Kantian thing. It's the context of it. Yeah. But the thing is, when you look at Tommy, though, who are you really supporting? It's Robin. It's that hyper-agency again. And what happens? What happens? It becomes like a sports team, doesn't it? Tommy emerges. We start giving him money, right? We start participating in the principality of Robinson because he is Robin. I mean, you know, it's Robinson. Isn't it funny? Robinson, Tommy Robinson. Yeah, obviously, he invented that name.
Yeah.
Sorry, possibly something.
Yeah, it's possibly deliberate, but I doubt it. I think the name Tommy Robinson was chosen just because it was like a sort of characteristic working class name, especially Tommy. And that even
Tommy was definitely
World War
chosen.
One, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Robin was probably... Sorry, go.
Yeah. No, you go.
I was just going to say, Robin was probably not on purpose, but that's probably something back there. But fundamentally, there's something in us that connects with his pattern of action, just not on purpose. He just happens to have these virtue practices, because in our value hierarchy, there's a relation between virtue and value. he's happened to stumble upon the virtue practices that allow him to have the possibility, which is kind of like something that builds up, right? A virtue is something that's embodied. You do a bunch of practices, weightlifting, whatever it may be, that gives you the possibility to enact this pattern of action of a hero, let's say Robin. That pattern of action is in the Englishman's value hierarchy, in the other Englishman, all of us, right? So around that recipe that Tommy enacted, there's a context, which is the Sheriff of Nottingham, which is pushing on the scenario. You need all these things. You need these things all together for it to trigger. Because let's say a dragon attacks a village. I respond with my pattern of action. You go, you get attracted. That's hero. A kid steals a chocolate bar from a store. I slay him in the same way as the dragon. You go, that's bad, right? But I use the same patterns of action. So it needs the context as well, right? So the context, all of that stuff comes together. His virtue practices to meet that recipe, though, right? But that doesn't mean we know what the virtue practices are. But he stumbled upon it, whatever he stumbled upon, that gave him this ability to face the tyranny. Because think about the pressure that was on him. And people like Nigel Farage are the same, right? It's the pressure, it's the attack. And we see that fundamentally. Yeah. And it's in us. We sense it. That's why he got the support. It's people like Paul, people like you. It's resisting this thing. And people, why do people donate to you? It's not just because you're doing what they like. It's because it's something fundamentally that's in them that impels them from within. And that's what survives the propaganda. And so that's what we can take the white pill from, is that that's still in our being. That's still in our being. And we can rekindle that, man. And that's what's coming. I think more people are coming up. More people are understanding this stuff. And even if we can't retake the whole thing, whatever it is, we're still building the ark. We're building the ark, man. So, yeah.
That's great. I mean, that's a nice optimistic notion there. And I do agree. And I hope that a people is dependent on more than... Or can be sustained by things other than material luxury, wealth, food, money. I hope that there is something deeper, which will take over when the world is sickly, like it is now. I think that's a reasonable thing to hope for. Some questions here. Sorry, go on.
I'll just respond to what you said. We respond to this. The more you take away is when we just get going. This is bleak heroic necessity. Tom would have gets it with Ragnarok. Towards Ragnarok, this is raw martial will in the face of adversity, because we knew this is pre-Christian crisis at the top of this, but still in our value hierarchy, right? Is that fundamentally, when the shit gets bad, this is Dunkirk spirit, this is all this Protestant work ethic, it's all bullshit, it's this bleak heroic necessity. This is what the true value is. Same with tall poppy syndrome, it's all connected to this bleak heroic necessity. The worse stuff gets, okay, let me render in this in a proposition. The more, the worse the situation, the worse the odds, the higher the zeal and the higher the spirit the Englishman must be. That's a proposition of what this is, right? And that's because in this old cosmology, it was an end. There was no heaven. The place that we went to was apocalypse and war. So that was the highest good. That was the highest good. You got to get yourself into this cosmology, right? Is that the way these people used to think is the highest good was dying in battle, right? There's no fleeing. And that's still us. That's still in our value hierarchy. So if you take these pleasant things away, people say, oh, the English are weak. They've lost their values. Take the stuff away. Take it away. And this will start to brew. This thing, this bleak heroic necessity, right? So the worst stuff gets, that's when we just get going. Yeah. Anyway, what are we just saying, right? I'm ranting.
No, it's all right. It's okay. I mean, again, I hope you're right. And I do think this, that, and I've said it myself for many years now, that I think luxury, you know, I'm not making any pretensions here. I'm a creature of luxury myself. But I think that luxury is bad for people, for peoples, for groups, because it detaches you from necessity, from truth, from honor, from honesty, and you end up, because nothing really matters, and so you forget, you stop preserving that which should be preserved. And my hope is that if luxury goes away, then people will get more real, that they would get more honest again, more honorable again. So it's a thing. I mean, I think if you could maintain, if the powers, let's say the daemon, could maintain luxury indefinitely, that would be very bad news for us.
Well, that's what they're doing. That's what they're trying to do. Keep you on U-Hub, sorry, U-Porn, right? You wake up, you scroll, you jerk off. That's what they want, right? You need to inhabit these virtue practices. Bring virtue back into your life. You can escape this stuff in these old ways, but you can exact the technology too. You can use internet blockers, right? Scheduled internet blockers. Don't just not use the technology, but these old virtues. You know, there's great people to follow. There's, you know, Rogag Nationalist, BAP, all these guys. People are talking about this stuff. This is a movement to try to recover this stuff, to protect ourselves. And if this ends up being a vanguard, that's fine. I hope it's populist. But if it ends up being a vanguard, whatever, it's the arc. Let's be the guys that protect ourselves from this hedonistic corruption, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. This is an illness. And, you know, you want to purge yourself.
An attack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it definitely is. I mean, it even feels like that, you know, when our country and our populace, our history, our heritage, our identity, all of these things are continually being denigrated. Yeah, it's an attack, for sure. There are two questions for you. Somebody asks whether you're on Odyssey. Where can we find and support your work?
It's just search my name, Scott Mannion, on Odyssey. It'll come. It's a small... YouTube is where it's mainly done, but yeah, it uploads to Odyssey as well. So that'd be good, actually, if more people went on Odyssey, just in case I get banned from YouTube. You never know. I'm not that spicy. I'm not. I just post on cultural things, but yeah.
Yeah, I think you'll probably be okay. I actually think that the way, and I said this the other night, I think that the wave of bannings and purgings from YouTube is probably over now.
Yeah.
I hope so, for the sake of those who are still on there. I got banned. So it's not my problem, but thank you. It's not my problem, but I do, you know what I actually miss more than, and this is going to sound pious, but it's true. What I miss more than having my own channel on YouTube is I miss the ecosystem that used to exist on there. It was like a garden. It was so fun.
Yeah.
And so, because key channels have been deleted, the whole ecosystem has kind of fallen apart, and I really miss that, because it was like this inferno of activity in 2014 to 17, and it was just, it's difficult not to be nostalgic for it.
Well, it's just gross what they've done in that way, because I can feel this now. I've only just entered this and I can feel it. It's beautiful, man. Like, just, you reached out to me, you know, people I've reached out to, these are, you know, there's good people out there, good, honest people, right? There are some there's some grifters, right, that we've got to purge, but I think that, I'm not big on purging or whatever, but there are grifters out there, right? But there are good people out there that are trying to take over from the sort of neoliberal Peterson-esque thing, which is just not grounded in people. You got to ground it in people, you got to ground it in a fundamental thing and an overarching theology.
Absolutely.
And there's a movement out there. There's Rorag Nationalists. There's all these people. And you're having a lot of them on. I think, look, you've got Auron. You had Auron on last year. All these people. This is still an event that people come back to, that, right? It's still a part of the calendar. So it's not even still. It's a part of the calendar. So, it's moving when you enter that community. Rorag Nationalist was very nice to me. And they just had him on, right? He's just a very good guy. Englishman. Noble Chad, as I call them, right? There's good people that are helping each other, and it's a mutual rising's good. And we need, I saw this post on Twitter actually that was really cool, which is all this. It was a list of what friends need to do, like loyalty, not backstabbing, because there was too much backstabbing in this political scene before. It's sort of getting rid of all that. It's just, no, be good people, help each other mutually, lift in this scene, right? It's scene, that's a pretty gay word, but you know what I mean. That's right. Let's
Inferno.
Not be this principality thing. Yes. Let's be good. You know, I'm Christian, but good Christians about this, right? Even I had Tom on, right? I have pagan people on. Like, it's okay. I'm not going to be, if that's people's religion, that's fine, right? And if some Englishman, you can either be pagan or you can be Christian. That's it. Anything else? No. Anyway, I'm just saying. But yeah. You know what I mean? This mutual lifting. But anyway, I'll throw it back to you.
Absolutely. A high tide raises all ships. I do believe that. I mean, if it were a huge marketplace, then we could afford infighting and, you know, whatever. Not that I would like it, but it could be sustained. But we don't have that. And so
we even need pragmatically,
absolutely. So we just need to support each other. And I wish that everyone understood that. A high tide raises all ships. That is something that really, I want that idea to spread. Mm. Okay, and then the other question, I think there's maybe more to say about the YouTube and all that, but it's the point is, we have other places now. There is Odyssey, there is Rumble, other places. Who knows what will happen in the future? But I think that it's something that is very valuable. If not for anything else, then just for momentum, just for morale, and a sense of camaraderie. I mean, everyone needs that. So, okay. Lady of Shalott says, thrilled to find Scott on Millennial. I've been a follower of his work for some time. I love Arthurian legend, Tolkien, and Old English lore. Scott is superb on this. What does Scott think Tolkien would make of the times we are living in? And what advice might he give us on the challenges we face? That's a big question, isn't it?
It's a big question. What would Tolkien say? I think he would say that the sort of the prophetic element of Saruman had begun manifesting itself across the Shire. I think he would say that from the ashes of fire shall be woken, and the grandest again shall be king at some point, right? From the roots, you know, the roots are protected from the frost. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. Just remember that we never renewed the blade. The king hasn't returned. And on Arthur's sword, it says, take me. On the back, it says, throw me away. In our moral order, it specifically states that we are supposed to, the king is supposed to, or a king, it doesn't have to be Charles, it can be someone, it can be a Cromwell. It specifically states that an Arthur is supposed to rise and cast down the tyranny, right, and remove it. So it could be the case in this moral order. So don't, and it could return to Parliament after that, that's fine. But this rise of a Cromwell is supposed to happen in the English moral order. It's specific in the mythos, right? Rising. So hopefully this moral order is understood by someone out there, a Caesar of some kind, that rises and can have 100 years or 50 years, whatever time it takes to restore the moral order, because that's what Robin does. Robin, Arthur, they restore the order of the place. These are radical traditionalists. Robin Hood is not a liberal. He's not a libertarian. He feasts on the king's deer, right? He has it in his being. He loves no man more than he loves the king. All these idiot communists and these idiot libertarians who claim him as their... Sorry, libertarians. I know some probably watch this. But they claim him as their guy. No. He's Catholic. He goes to Mary. He kills corrupt papists, right, for the king. Kills it for the wider geist of it. And so what this ultimately is a restoring of English order, because English aren't anti... They're not anti, and Tolkien, not anti-authority. Tolkien is not anti-authority. He's pro-benevolent, which means English authority. If you act in an English way, we want a king to govern in an English way. It's not bad. It's a good thing. They're working for the hierarchy. It's never thrown out, right? And I've read all the original sources. You can't beat me on this. This is what it is. This is the moral order of it. So I would say, what would Tolkien say? I'd say things are getting bad, but this is what it looked like at book three before Aragorn took the throne. And so, yeah, let's see what happens. And even if it doesn't build the Ark, but building the Ark. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not for us to choose what time we live in, but et cetera, the old Gandalf quote. So, yeah. All right. Excellent. Well, this has been a really good stream. So thank you very much for appearing.
Sorry, it was late.
It's fine. These things happen. I could be more explicit. I never know how much to say that stuff. All right. Is there any final things you'd like to say?
That's it. I mean, my YouTube, Scott Mannion, MANNION, Scott Mannion, or my just go greenwood.media. It's got all my links there. Yeah. God bless and God save the king.
All right. Excellent. Okay. I will be back in about 10 minutes with Vico Hesler. In the meantime, Scott Mannion, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you, man. See you later. All the best.
Okay, we'll be back soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.